Hey, here's something you should know. Some experts estimate that up to 77% of the population has some level of speaking anxiety. I actually thought it was higher than that. Strong communication is a critical skill for success, which is why I'd like to recommend a podcast I know you're going to love called Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by the folks at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the number one career podcast in over 95 countries. And here's why. Each week, Stanford lecturer Matt Abrahams, who, by the way, has been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you improve all kinds of skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, keeping your nerves in check while speaking in front of crowds. I mean, there's a reason this show has over 42 million downloads and counting. You'll hear from people like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, speechwriter and best-selling author Daniel Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness that nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube, and you can tell them I sent you. Today on Something You Should Know, we start with some ways to improve your mood when you're stuck inside your house and can't go anywhere. Then proven ways to get people to like you almost instantly.
In technical terms, it's the quality and the quantity of the energy they give off, but it's basically their attitude more than anything else, because your attitude not only drives your behavior, it drives other people's behavior.
Also, how to make a quick, easy, and effective homemade hand sanitizer, and the negative power of complaining, why you should stop complaining and stop being around people who do.
Studies out of Stanford show that if you expose yourself to 30 minutes of complaining every day, it does physical damage to the brain. You know, people previously know that if they're around a complainer, they feel the energy seeping out of them. Well, we now know why that is the case. It's complaining is doing physical damage.
All this today on Something You Should Know. If you employ people, you know that finding the right person to fill a job opening can be daunting. And you know, most people I know who run a business don't really have a proven system to do this. It can be real hit or miss, which is why if you're hiring, you need Indeed. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed is a whole hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates and find them fast. So what I love about Indeed is when you use it, you get this feeling of confidence that, yeah, this is the way to find the right people. You're not winging it or just sorting through resumes hoping to find someone. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from you. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. There's so many reasons to use Indeed, and there are so many reasons not to do this on your own. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/something. Just go to Indeed.com/something right now. That helps to support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/something. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Something you should know. Fascinating intel, the world's top experts, and practical advice you can use in your life. Today, Something You Should Know with Mike Carruthers.
Hi, welcome to Something You Should Know. With all this sitting around not having a lot to do, I know it's making a lot of people grumpy and upset and depressed. And so a psychologist has come up with several scientifically proven activities that can boost your mood almost instantly. First of all, get up. No snooze button, no staying in bed till the very last second. Just get up, open the curtains, let in the natural light, and get your day going. Listen to your favorite song. Scientists have found that listening to music changes the way we perceive the world for the better. Try to notice the good. It's easier to focus on what's wrong, but do the opposite, and it will bring you joy. Laugh. Research shows that laughter soothes tension, improves your immune system, and even eases pain. See a friend. Maybe don't get too close, but see a friend or talk to a friend. Friends make you feel good, and they are good for you. And perform a random act of kindness. It stimulates the release of endorphins, and there's a strong relationship between this type of activity and increased self-esteem and self-worth. And that is something you should know. You know how some people that you meet are just, they're just more likable. People are drawn to them. They have that instant rapport thing. So how is it that they do that? And could you do that? Well, Nicholas Boothman thinks so. Nicholas has been mastering personal communication strategies for quite a while, and he is author of a book called How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less. Hi, Nicholas.
Thank you. Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
So it's interesting when I think about when I meet someone for the first time, there is that immediate judgment, that immediate sense of whether I like that person or not, right? That's what humans do. We make that instant judgment to some extent, right?
The truth is that we decide how we feel about someone in the first 2 seconds of seeing them or hearing them if it's on the phone. It's just part of the fight or flight response. So you can't really blame people for doing it. I mean, you can't stop them jumping to conclusions about you, but there's a lot you can do to adjust how they feel about you.
And that idea that people like or don't like you within the first few seconds, so what's going on there? What makes that determination?
Actually, the fight or flight response is four things in mammals. It's it's about safety. Am I safe or not? But we're actually deciding, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Do I fight it or do I run for it? I mean, those are basically what we're deciding. And we just pick up signals from other people that tell us how we feel about them.
But there are people that, you know, they don't make us necessarily want to run away, but there's something about them. They're not quite my kind of guy. You know what I mean? But it's not like I want to run away from them.
No, absolutely. What does freak us out are mixed messages. Basically, we respond to the visual, the vocal, and the verbal. In other words, when your voice tone, your words, and your body language are all saying the same thing, we tend to trust you. I mean, that's what actors do. They're very good at that. But if they're not saying the same thing, you know, if someone's smiling whilst they're angry at you or looking, I mean, I have people all the time when I do my talks come up to me, and I had a woman recently came up and said, you know, I have this problem. My kids are always saying, Mom, why are you so angry all the time? And she says, I'm not angry. I'm excited. So, well, you look angry. And that was simply because, her body language and her words and her voice tone weren't all saying the same thing. That's what freaks us out. You know, those people that smile at you when they're angry at you. Like, you know.
And so what is it, because we all know those people that everybody is attracted to, they walk into a room and pretty soon everybody's around that. What is that?
You know, first of all, I do get asked that a lot, and that's not exactly what really happens. Sure, there are some people that walk into a room that attracts people's attention, but they're not suddenly all around them. But they're people they feel comfortable with. Their body language is giving off. Basically, it's what I talk about doing in the first 2 or 3 seconds of seeing someone. Look them in the eye, smile, open your body language, and synchronize with the people around you, and then look for common ground. When you see certain people and you tend to be attracted to them. Look, I was a fashion photographer for 25 years. I had studios on three continents, and I mean, I know why people are attracted to models. It's things like their faces and are symmetrical. That's a huge attraction when someone is symmetrical. When they do eye contact, look, it's simple. A smile says I'm happy and I'm confident. Eye contact says trust is in the air. These are quite simple things.
So when you want to make someone like you, I mean, it almost sounds phony. It's like, do I really want to make someone like me? If they don't like me, they don't like me.
If cooperation is what you want, then there are certain things you can do, which I just mentioned then. Look them in the eye, smile, open your body language, and they will start to feel trusting towards you. And it happens in the first couple of seconds.
But if it doesn't happen in the first couple of seconds, have you lost the opportunity or not?
It's difficult. Look, here's the bottom line. When people like you, they tend to see the best in you and what you represent. And we tend to look for opportunities to say yes to people that we like. When we don't like them, the opposite's true. We tend to see the worst in them or get out of here now. You know, your subconscious is saying, back away. And we sometimes see the worst. If the guy's jumping all over the place and I like him, he's enthusiastic. If I don't like him, he's an idiot. You know, if I like the woman, she's warm and she's approachable. If I don't like her, she's dull and boring. It's all the same body language, really. And so it does matter, because when we like people, you know, they tend to see the best of us in us. And that's really what it's all about. And not only in us, but in what we represent. I know that you're people who haven't heard your program and tune into it. In the first couple of seconds, they're either saying, "Yeah, I like this. I like this guy." Or they're saying, "What else is on?" Well, I say that with the greatest of respect. Obviously,
of course.
You have the voice I wish I had. You have a super charismatic voice, and etc., which is what you should darn well have after 20 years.
What about, though, because you say, you know, it happens in the first few seconds that you, when you open up the body language and everything, but it's also your personality, your attitude. I mean, I've seen people that look very appealing, and then you start to talk to them and go, "Oh my God," you know, what?
Yeah.
So what is that? Talk about that.
Well, first of all, that's the good news and the bad news about face-to-face communication is you're a genius until you open your mouth. But the fact that you said the word there, the attitude, the first thing we respond to in somebody else, well, in technical terms, it's the quality and the quantity of the energy they give off. But it's basically their attitude. It's your attitude more than anything else that determines your success or failure, because your attitude not only drives your behavior, it drives other people's behavior. I mean, you know, if you came on the air now and you were angry, I would be responding in a defensive way or whatever, or if you sounded angry, but you sound completely cool and together. So, you know, it makes me respond in a certain way. And that's, you know, I have people all the time that say when people get to know me, they really like me. But, you know, that's great for your next door neighbor and your family and anybody else who can't escape you, but you know, when it comes to work or to dating, it doesn't cut it.
What about this idea that people like people who are like them?
Well, yeah, we are attracted to people who are like ourselves. We like people who look. It's all about finding common ground. I mean, the bottom line in a first impression is the faster you can find common ground, the quicker you can just relax into it. And so we tend to like people who are like ourselves, who have the same taste in, I don't know, holidays, books, music, food. We like them, we get on with them, we can find, you know, in my talks I do audiences of up to 6,000 people quite regularly, and I'll get them on their feet and I'll just say, find common ground in 20 seconds with somebody. And, you know, they do it. They both like the movie Titanic. They've got twins in the family. They both enjoy certain sports. As soon as that happens, as soon as you find common ground, you've cracked it. You've made a great first impression.
What's a good way to do that, though? When you meet someone and you start talking to them, you can't say, "Well, let's find some common ground so we can continue this conversation." How do you have that conversation so that the common ground reveals itself?
I did this exactly this on Good Morning America a few years back, when they said, "Okay, so I walk into a room full of strangers. Give me 5 tips on what to do." And I said, "Well, number one, when you walk into a room, head for the middle of the room. Well, number one, wear great clothes. More people take you seriously. You don't have to wear spectacular clothes, but just dress for the occasion. Walk into the middle of the room. As you walk into the middle of the room, walk slightly more slowly." And then I tell them about the 3-second rule. you know, you're probably at these, one of these events to meet people. So go up to people and how do you get people talking? You do what you do. You do what podcasters do or talk show hosts do or journalists do. You ask an open question. You make a statement followed by an open question. So on the Today Show, she said, okay, well, what do you mean here? I say, okay, I hear New York's a fantastic place. If I only had half a day, what should I see? That's how you get me talking. You make a statement and you ask me an open question. That's what we can do with anybody. Make a statement about the occasion. If you're somewhere where you're supposed to talk to people, we call those closed fields. It could be an event. It could be a networking thing. It could be an interview like this. The intention is that we talk to each other. In open fields, which are slightly different, there's a different way of talking to complete strangers. And talking to strangers is really what I've been focusing on for the last couple of years in my talks, because life doesn't happen without talking to strangers. And we're in a real mess as far as talking to strangers in the world right now.
I'm talking with Nicholas Boothman, who has some very helpful advice. His book is called How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less. Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s. The breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
So, Nicholas, some people just seem to have that gift, it seems anyway, that they can talk to strangers and make everybody feel comfortable. Do you think that's true, or are they working at it? It just looks easy.
It just looks easy. I have 5 children. The total age of my kids now is actually 225. So I've got 3 of them in their 50s and, you know, a couple arriving in their 40s. And they weren't all naturally able to go up to complete strangers and start a conversation, but they practiced. And we had fun little things that we did as when they were growing up that made one of my children in particular, who might have been, other people might have used the label I absolutely abhor, which is shy, attach shy to somebody. But she could have been that way. But today she runs corporations out of Norway and high-tech corporations and networks all over the world, but only because we showed her how to do it and we encouraged her to do it. Look, the first thing I talk about to my audience is I ask them, Professor Harrell from Stanford Business School spent 20 years looking for what he called the success factor. He went across all areas of work and business and private life, and their team, with one thing, which was they called the number one identifiable predictor of success. And you know what it was? It was the ability to speak up. If you don't speak up, you're invisible. And that's what makes all of the difference in these things.
That is so interesting because, and you had said just a few moments ago, you go into the center of the room and talk to someone. Well, to a lot of people, that's terrifying to just talk to someone. But a lot of people don't think they can do that.
Well, you know, here's something else, but I mean, I'm slightly off on a tangent, but you know, something we had to learn to have no confidence. We were all born with just two fears. the fear of sudden loud noises and the fear of falling, all the rest of the things we get scared about in this life, we had to learn. They're learned fears. And I deal a lot of the time now with, I'm dealing, working with our local police force and with human trafficking and helping in that area, doing what little bit I can to help. But, you know, a lot of it comes down to not having confidence. Confidence is a huge topic right now. With digital distractions and political correctness and polarized politics, we've made strangers out of everybody. And the result is an epidemic of anxiety and depression and a lack of confidence. But, you know, confidence is, they say, oh, well, face your fears and do it anyway, or fake it till you make it. This is to answer your question about going into a room and talking to people. But the simple thing about confidence is that people who are confident are comfortable with rejection and they're comfortable with failure. Just those two things. So I have some simple steps where anyone can get comfortable with rejection and anyone can get comfortable with failure. That's what makes people lack the confidence. And so to walk into a room and talk to people, you just need a couple of steps to explain to people that there's no such thing as failure. There's only feedback. The whole idea of failure is that we learn to get better. And the whole idea of there's no such thing as rejection. There's only selection. Thank God when I was 15 and used all my pocket money to go and have cha-cha lessons so I could get the girl from the local hairdressing salon to fall in love with me. Thank God she rejected me or I wouldn't be where I am today. You know.
So those invisible signals, those things that you send off that make people say to themselves, oh, this is a likable guy. Those are what?
Yeah, well, eye contact is huge. What I tell people is when you meet someone for the first time, look them in the eye, smile, open your body language, and find common ground. But first, you have to adjust your attitude. And you have to adjust your attitude to what I call a really useful attitude instead of a really useless attitude. A really useful attitude could be welcoming, curious, enthusiastic, warm. Really useless attitudes are things like bored, rude, hostile, or appearing that way. A lot of people don't realize with their arms folded and looking at the ground when they're talking to you for the first time that they just come across as hostile. So first you adjust your attitude, which is before you even approach somebody or even walk into a room. We all do it when we walk into a room. We adjust our attitude to something or other. It's put a smile on your face and get on with it. And then eye contact, just notice the color of the eyes of the people that you're talking to. That's enough eye contact to put trust in the air. Now, I did some work for one of the large automotive companies. Well, I've done all of them, but in one of them, and when we got on this subject, they now have on their worksheet in their service department, customer's name, customer's address, customer's eye color. It just obliges the mechanic for a second to look into the eyes of the customer. That says trust is in the air. A smile, whether you have a natural smile or not, a smile says that person is happy and confident. Not everybody has a natural smile, and not all professional models have a natural smile. But there's a trick I learned from models when I was a photographer. They simply say, they'll say to themselves the word great in bursts of three in stupid voices. Great, 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 when they're on the set. And eventually their eyes are warm and they look like they're smiling. You can say that to yourself as you approach somebody. Open your body language just means, you know, don't have your arms folded across your chest. In other words, simply kind of almost point your heart at the heart of the person, not in any stupid way, but just expose your heart. And then start saying something. And it's perfectly normal to make a comment about where you are. I had an awful time parking today. And what about you? Or isn't this a great place? Or I've never been here before. It's just making statements.
What do you mean by talking in color?
Well, it means that this is to be persuasive, it's a whole other level of communication. Talking in color means that we add sensory information into what we're talking about. When I get on my farm here, when I get briefings from corporations, sometimes I'll be on a conference call, there'll be the president and some members of the board, and they'll start talking, they'll say, hi, how are you? And I'll say, you know what, I'm just looking out the window right now, I can see the horses coming up the valley into the paddock. And I'll say that within the first few moments, and they're in, I've already straight into their imaginations. But talking in color, there's three things really. One of them is adding sensory information to whatever you're talking about. Talk about the way, if you're telling someone you went on holiday, you talk about the way some of the things that you saw, some of the things that you heard, maybe the smells, the tastes, involve all the senses. We're hungry. We're desperate. We're desperate for stories. Stories are to the human mind what food and fresh air are to the body. We just crave stories. And that's what your podcast is. It's a lot of it's just stories. It's getting into people's imaginations. The other part about talking in color, the big part, is being able to condense things into simple images. And one of the best people at doing this in the States is Warren Buffett. He makes pictures to describe things. When he was asked how he felt about his job, he said, "I tap dance to work." That's talking in color, because people who have kind of visual can see it. People who are sound, auditory, can hear it. And people who are feeling-based can feel it, can feel that what it feels like. When he was asked to explain the 2008 financial bust, he said, "The tide's gone out and we can see who's been swimming naked." Really great communicators, Steve Jobs, all those guys, you'll see they use metaphors all the time. They say it's kind of like a, and that's talking in color. And it's very charismatic. Look, for those of your listeners old enough to remember Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, he said, "I'm going to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee." This life is a bowl of cherries. This is absolute beautiful for the minds of other people, for the imagination. Imagination is the strongest force we possess.
It sure makes sense what you're saying, and yet it is so hard. It is hard for a lot of us to talk to people the way you're talking.
Just say hello to three people today that are strangers. Just say hi. Make it your goal to get rejected three times. Keep doing it if you want until three times nobody responds to you. That's all. I work with kids, and I was interviewing four kids in a cafe the other day. I walk up to them, and they've never been taught to talk to strangers. They've been told not to talk to strangers. You don't talk to strangers, you got no life. Everything you do in life, you're going to be healthier, wealthier, smarter, wiser, richer. The only way you're going to do it is by, you're going to need a stranger's help to do that. But this one girl said, "I mouth high people." I thought that's a great word. As she's walking by, and she's only 14, she just goes with her mouth, and look away again. And that's how they're learning to talk to strangers.
Yeah, well, I've always thought about this whole don't talk to strangers thing, that it's not necessarily such a great idea, because as you say, if you don't talk to strangers and you don't learn how, think of all the opportunities you're not getting.
Talking to strangers isn't just the right thing to do. It's a matter of survival. Everything we want in this life, be it tickets to the Rose Bowl, to be on your show, to have a great career, whatever, the perfect partner, you're going to need a stranger's help to get it. So all those people, they tell little children, don't talk to strangers. So the kid gets lost in the mall and goes and hides somewhere. Much better to say, if you get lost, go and talk to another mummy, or go and talk to the lady, somebody behind the counter. That's useful. It's about, this stranger danger, this fear of strangers is unbelievable. Do you know what your chances of a kid being kidnapped by a complete stranger are in the United States? The latest available figures were from 2016. The chance of your child being kidnapped by a complete stranger is 1 in 675,000. And yet we tell them all, don't talk to strangers. I've interviewed, and what have we got now? We have 1.5 generations of soft, narcissistic, decadent, over-photographed, under-inspired kids because it's not their fault. It's the way they've been brought up and brainwashed.
Well, I like your advice because it's simple, it's easy to follow, and I think people have a sense that it's probably pretty effective. You just have to go out and try it. Nicholas Boothman has been my guest. The book is How to Make People Like You in 90 seconds or less, and you will find a link to his book in the show notes. Thanks for being here, Nicholas.
I'm really grateful. Thank you so much.
You probably don't have to think too long or think about too many people in your life before you can come up with someone you know to be a complainer. Maybe even you complain a little more than you wish you did, or a little more than other people wish you did. Interestingly, complaining is more than just annoying. There are some real serious consequences to complaining, both from being a complainer and from having to listen to it. Here to discuss this is Trevor Blake. Trevor is an entrepreneur and author of several books, including Three Simple Steps. Hi, Trevor. Thanks for being here. And so, aside from being irritating to listen to, why should we be concerned about all the complaining going on?
Well, two reasons. The latest neuroscientific data shows that the brain works more like a muscle than we previously thought. So the more you repeat a behavior, the more you become that behavior. So if you surround yourself with a bunch of complainers, the more likely you are to become a complainer yourself. But that's only half the story. Studies out of Stanford show that if you expose yourself to 30 minutes of complaining every day, it does physical damage to the brain. It actually peels back the neurons in a part of the brain that we need for cognitive functioning, problem solving, and adapting to changing circumstances. Well, you know, we live in a world where everything's constantly changing, so that's not what you want. So, people previously know that if they're around a complainer, they feel the energy seeping out of them. Well, we now know why that is the case. It's complaining is doing physical damage, so you really have to either remove yourself from the source or shut off that source.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. So complainers are making us stupid.
Yeah, they're turning our brains to mush, in effect.
I think that people would like to think, and to some degree, I think you notice that some people are affected by that more than others. Other people can be around complainers, and there's a wall there, and it doesn't affect them, whereas other people, as you say, you know, it just sucks the life right out of you.
That's right, and I think a good way to think about it is the same as passive smoking. Some people seem to be okay sitting around a smoker when they're not a smoker, and other people just can't stand to be in the same room as a smoker. And I think of complaining as passive smoking. I grew up, my father was a chain smoker, and it was like growing up in a smoke-filled balloon. Well, I tried to change his behavior, but I failed at that because I was a kid and he was a father. So my only recourse was to actually remove myself from that toxic environment and go out into the fresh air. It's the same with complaining. If you feel that it bothers you or you feel affected by it, you've got to put distance between yourself and the source of that feeling.
Yeah, which is not always easy to do, because if they sit next to you at work or you married one, you're screwed.
That's absolutely true, and I have a real-life example now because I've been married 30 years, so I've known my mother-in-law 30 years, and I'm one of those unusual men that has nothing but good things to say about his mother-in-law. We have a great relationship. But she lives in a place where she's surrounded by people of a similar age who are always complaining about their health and the fact the economy is going south and their pension doesn't go as far, and it was much better in the old days. And when she comes to stay with us, she stays for 3 months. Well, for the first 2 weeks, this wizened old lady comes to the front door, and the first words out of her mouth are complaints about the food on the plane or the fact I drove too fast from the airport or the weather's not very nice. And my wife and I have learned over the years to just completely ignore that. Don't respond to it. Don't try and change the way she is. Just don't respond to it. And 2 weeks into her visit, it's like an alien came in and took the wizened old lady away, and they replaced her with everybody's favorite granny. And this is now somebody who has incredible energy, more energy even than I have, and doesn't limp anymore and just sees the good around her all the time. So the transformation is remarkable, but it happens because the brain hardwires into whatever stimulus it's getting. So where she lives, she's getting negative stimulus all the time. When she's with us, she's in a much more positive environment, and the results can be seen both in her attitude and in her actual physical health.
And is she aware of what happened? Could she consciously explain it the way you just did?
We do have those conversations, actually, around the kitchen table on a regular basis. And she's aware of it, but when she goes back to her environment in Europe and gets back into those conversations with all the people who are complaining around her, you know, my wife calls her every day once she gets back. And I can gradually tell from listening into the conversations that she slowly sinks into that wizened old lady again, and she gets back into that complaining mentality because she's hard. She can't separate herself from those people around her in her environment, or chooses not to, and so her brain hardwires back into that old way of thinking.
So if you just ignore it, it goes away?
Yes, if you just ignore it, then, I mean, if you ignore the complaining, then you're not exposing your brain to those complaints. you know, it's not easy to do. I mean, it's easy to do if you have control over the source of that complaining. So we have a degree of control in our home over whether we pay attention or respond or react to anything we see on TV or hear from somebody's voice. You know, if you're in the workplace or somewhere else, it's less easy to ignore it, and you have to take a more a physical reaction to it. So, you know, leave the room or take a bathroom break, you know, those sorts of things.
But going back to your mother-in-law, what do you think would happen if she's if she arrived there as kind of this complaining person, and that's kind of her personality with you, and let's say it was also her personality when she's around someone else, person B, and around you, though, over the course of time, she got better and she stopped complaining. If she were to go next door to person B, would she just start complaining all over again, or would you have changed her internally within her, or just with you?
No, it's changed internally within her for as long as she allows that to happen. So if she went next door and had coffee, which she does actually, she goes next door and has coffee with our Irish friend, and, you know, I have Irish blood in me, so I can say this, you know, the Irish are typically a bunch of complainers. We enjoy complaining. If she's there for a couple of hours, when she comes back, she will bring some of those complaints back with her, and we have to respond the same way. We just ignore it. We smile, you know, shake it off and ignore it. But I'm afraid some people just do not protect their brains enough to avoid it being immediately rewired. I think of the brain as a, you know, electric circuit. It needs to find a source of power, and so it pays attention to whatever it feels is the nearest source of power, unless you do something about that.
If complaining has that effect on us, what else has an effect on us like that? I mean, it makes it sound as if our brains are pretty vulnerable to outside stimulus. Like, what else?
Well, I think we live in a world where there's constant noise around us, and of course, most of the noise these days is from the negative and sensational media that's around us. That's a very strong source of complaining and negativity. And I know a lot of people who are obsessed with their 30 seconds of Fox News, and they can't survive without it. And that's because their brain knows that that's the source of energy that it's going to. So, you know, in three simple steps, the step one is all about finding inside yourself again that pioneering spirit we were born with. Well, you can't find that spirit if you become a slave to the fashion or the trend that the TV and the newspapers are influencing you with all the time. And very often, what grabs people's attention is something fearful. If we see something fearful, we stop and we're paralyzed and we pay attention to it. And so, of course, media works on that. It's just a natural part of the way we live today, that the media will throw out a sensational headline and it freezes us and we pay attention to it. You know, you have to protect yourself from that just the same as you have to protect yourself from being surrounded by complainers.
Does it work the other way, that if you're around, say, you know, really happy, upbeat, positive, optimistic people, that'll rub off just as well? Or does it only work in the negative?
No, you're absolutely right. It works in the opposite way as well, because, you know, I have yet to meet a self-made man or woman who's a complainer or who's fixated with daily news. They're people who are outgoing and always looking forward, never looking back. And if you were to read the autobiographies of people like Carnegie and Ford, you know, it becomes quite clear very early on in those autobiographies that these were men who didn't really care about what just happened 5 minutes ago, because it's in the history. And so they're not going to moan and groan about what went wrong. They're looking always in a sort of solution-oriented fashion. So they're always looking forward. And so you can choose to take that approach, and your life will reflect the results of that.
So knowing what you know, I mean, what else can we, you know, the complaining thing is a great example of what you're talking about. But what else is it that you know that I could use in my life like that would help me?
Well, first of all, the first step is to be aware that complaining is affecting you, or that you may suddenly become aware that, you know what, I do watch a lot of my morning news. You know, I do get up in the morning and switch on my radio and listen to depressing information about the economy. But maybe I should change that behavior. And so instead of getting up and doing that, maybe I'll get up and spend 10 minutes by myself and just sit quietly and just allow my brain to function at its natural speed of light and think about the day ahead, what I'm going to do with my day. It's just changing that pattern of behavior makes a huge difference in outcome.
Well, it sounds like, you know, your brain is the result of what you put into it, that, you know, if you put stuff into it that's whiny and complainy, you're a whiner and a complainer.
Yes, I think we become a reflection of the environment around us.
So knowing that, though, that means you can make changes to turn yourself into someone else.
Yes, you can change. If you change your pattern of behavior, then you'll change the outcomes. I mean, it's the same old saying of if you keep repeating the old behaviors, you'll get the same results. Well, you have to make just very small changes in the way that you live, and you'll have tremendous changes in the outcome. So, you know, best example and simple examples would be that if you are stressing out because you are up to your eyes in credit card debt, but you have a tendency to watch TV news that's every 5 minutes they've got a commercial about credit card debt solutions, you're just going to create in your mind this whole stress level of credit card debt because you're thinking about it all the time. So the way to change that is to selectively remove those commercials from your stimuli. And when your credit card bill comes through the door, instead of panicking about it, you'll say something out loud like, when I'm free of credit card debt, I'll buy myself a bottle of champagne and pay for it in cash. You just change the reaction, because in life it's not what we think that's important. It's how we react to what we think. It's difficult to control what we think because it's often instantaneous to something that stimulated that thought. So the only thing we have control on is how we react to that thought. And so you have to make these little changes, and it makes a huge difference.
Well, I can imagine somebody listening to you, though, and thinking, well, yeah, this all sounds good, but he doesn't have my life. I mean, you know, I've got that credit card debt, plus I just lost my job. They're going to foreclose on my house. And changing my reaction isn't going to solve any of that.
No, and they're good arguments, and so I would say, well, I'm living proof of all of that, because I grew up in a dirt poor family. We were evicted 3 times before I was 7 years old. When I was 8, my mother was given 6 months to live, and she was one of the great inspirations in my life, because I was there when she looked through the kitchen window and looked up to the God in the sky, and she said, if you think I'm coming now, you've got another thing coming. I'm not leaving my children until they're all fully grown. And she held on to that, and she was a woman of her word. So she fought against incredible chronic pain for 14 years until we all left the nest. During that time, my father was unemployed that whole time. We lived on welfare. It was quicksand to me. And I found in all the autobiographies of these successful self-made men and women similar backgrounds. Most of them had started in worse circumstances than even I found myself in, but they found a way out. And so I did the same thing. And I got out of that quicksand and lived a life of adventure. But all adventures are bumpy. And at times on that bumpy adventure, I found myself up to my eyes in credit card debt. But I found a way out of that too, doing exactly the same thing as I had done to get out of the original quicksand. So the three simple steps work, and you just have to apply that in whatever situation you find yourself in, and it will help you get out of that quicksand. It'll give you the confidence to know that you can change everything that's happened up to this point in time.
Do you think, though, that there's a kind of a expectation or a mentality today that, like you just said, that, you know, life has got bumps in the road, that people expect that if their life was really good, there would be no bumps? That life, you know, when we do read or see on TV about these wonderfully wealthy and famous people, it seems as if their life is so carefree, and that is what a good life is.
No, I think life would be a little boring if it was like that. I mean, you know, I go back to it's not what you think about a situation, but how you react to it that defines the quality of your life. So, you know, I've been married 30 years. I've had a wonderful relationship. But during that 30 years, my wife has been told she's got 6 months to live, not once, but 3 times. And she chose to react to it differently than a lot of the people who were around her in the hospital who were given similar prognosis. I was also given 6 months to live in 1989. I refused to believe that. I chose a different reaction, if you like. So although my life has been an extraordinary adventure, there have been moments in it where there's been a challenge that's right in my face that I've had to decide how I'm going to react to that. And whenever I face those challenges, I go back to the recipe that is in Three Simple Steps, and that is maintain my individual opinion and thoughts, be disciplined, so I keep my pioneering spirit. I find ways to create great ideas and plans and action, which is step two, that allows me to react differently to these circumstances. And then I execute on that plan, which is step three. And it's always helped me. I mean, here I am, I'm talking to you, and I'm now 50 and very healthy. But there was a time when I might have reacted differently, and I wouldn't have been here.
Well, I think most people would react differently. I mean, if somebody tells you have 6 months to live, to react the way you reacted is exceptional, and I think difficult. I think most people would just go the other way, be very depressed and sad, and accept that is a reality, and, you know, that's it.
Yeah, I think some people do. I obviously was given a fantastic real life lesson by watching how my mother dealt with the situation. And, you know, she told her God that she wasn't dying, and I believed her. And that unshakable belief is something that I also found in the lives of all those self-made men and women. They just developed this unshakable belief that regardless of the circumstances that they find themselves in, they're going to find a way out. And they always do.
As
have I.
Can you just, before I let you go, the three simple steps, can you just state them and just give a couple of sentences, just like one or two sentences of what each one means?
Yes, step one is about finding that pioneering spirit that we were all born with, but life and our environments tends to suppress over time. You don't get to be successful by being a slave to other people's opinions and fashions and trends. You get to be successful by having confidence in your own intuition to make a good and strong decision for yourself. So in order to get to that individualism, you do have to learn to be selective about what you're allowing to influence yourself. So you're selective with the media, selective with the people you surround yourself with, and you will find yourself gaining incredible control over your mentality when that happens. Step two, the thing I hear most often is somebody telling me that they'd really like a better life, or they'd like to start a company, or they want to change the way they are right now, but they just don't have any great ideas. So step two is all about putting yourself in a position to have those moments of insight, because it's that one brilliant idea that separates the successful from the mediocrity. And there's a few techniques to get to that point, and that's probably the most rewarding feedback I get from the book, is that people who take to heart step two just have so many fantastic ideas, and their life just changes from being somewhat boring to being just an incredible adventure. And then step three is how you take those great ideas and you turn them into the reality of your experience. It's important. You can use any one of the steps in any order, just like you could use an ingredient you could use flour, butter, and sugar by themselves. But when you mix them together and you put the appropriate heat and the appropriate energy behind it, then it transforms into a beautiful cake. Well, the same thing with three simple steps. Used together in the right order, it transforms lives, and it's been an absolute blast to watch how people's lives have been changed by this.
Well, your story is inspiring, and I love what you said about complaining and complainers. Trevor Blake has been my guest. His book is Three Simple Steps, and you'll find a link to that book in the show notes for this episode. I'm sure you know, you've probably experienced that, like other things, hand sanitizer is hard to come by, but you can make your own without a whole lot of trouble. It's really easy. Here's what you do. You take 3/4 of a cup of isopropyl alcohol or rubbing alcohol, and that's still pretty much available in drugstores. Then you add to that 1/4 cup of aloe vera gel, which helps keep your hands smooth and to counteract the harshness of that alcohol. And then you just add like 10 drops of essential oil like lavender oil, or you can even just use lemon juice. And then you whisk them all together in a bowl until it turns into a gel. The trick is you want to make sure you keep that 2-to-1 proportion of alcohol to aloe vera, which keeps the alcohol content at around 60%. You need 60%. That's the minimum needed to kill most germs, according to the CDC. And this recipe comes from Dr. Rishi Desai, who is chief medical officer of an organization called Osmosis. He's a former Epidemic Intelligence Service officer in the Division of Viral Diseases at the CDC, and I figure he probably knows what he's talking about. We'll put a link up to the article that has this recipe in it so you can go back and get it when you need it to make your own hand sanitizer. Now, I'm sure there are people in your life, friends, family, who, like you, are probably sitting around without a whole lot to do. So let me suggest that you share this podcast with them. I'm sure they'll appreciate it, and it'll engage them and help pass the time. I'm Mike Carruthers. Thanks for listening today to Something You Should Know.